filmmakers making films about filmmakers. What more could we be asking for here on the No Film School podcast? This is Gigi Hawkins, and this week I speak with Eric Sasso, a filmmaker, photographer, and creative executive, and the editor of Maxine's Baby, a Tyler Perry story. The film documents the remarkable life of Tyler Perry, billionaire writer, actor, filmmaker, studio head, media mogul, and takes us to his roots in a very intimate and personal way. In my conversation with Eric, we talk about his beginnings, you know, creating films with friends in middle school and high school, to his sort of moments of getting into the industry, writing, directing, producing, and editing a music video for the Wu-Tang Clan, which was honored as the number one best video for Time. We also geek out about his process crafting the story within Premiere and how his work as an editor informs his work as a director and every other hat that he puts on as a filmmaker. And now my interview with Eric Sasso. Eric, welcome. Thank you for joining us on the No Film School podcast with your Clubhouse microphone.
Got it right here. Thank you for having me, Gigi. I'm excited.
It's good. It sounds good, loud and clear. So wait, was Clubhouse like Discord, but people would sign on and it would be like virtual podcasts, like real-time podcasts? Remind me what it was.
It was the one that comes before Twitter Spaces. So Twitter Spaces basically happened because of Clubhouse.
And are people using, is Twitter Spaces still a thing? I'm like, it's so interesting, these virtual hangout spaces.
I think it's a little bit of a thing for like the Web3 community for sure. Mm-hmm. They're pretty heavy in it. I don't know. I think it was like a pandemic lockdown kind of thing. And people at the time, they gravitated towards it. And then after that, it was kind of like, all right, I'm going outside again. I'm not going to sit by the microphone anymore.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Which I guess I'm pro, except for now I'm dragging you back here on the mic to talk in our platform Riverside, which we're big fans of now. And we are here to talk about your work as the editor of Maxine's Baby. But we're also here to talk about your work as a filmmaker, both in the director's seat, in the editor's seat. I mean, you touch all the points. So I'm curious, how did you get your start in this space?
Well, I was somebody who I guess had the somewhat of a fortune to know that I was going to ruin my life being a filmmaker. So I knew pretty early on.
It's a club
about middle school.
Middle school.
Yeah, nice. You know, I mean, we're cool with it. Yeah, some probably by high school. Like middle school, I was writing a lot. I got into photography, met my best friend, my now best friend and creative partner, Brian Wendelken, in high school in a creative writing class. And he was kind of like, why don't we write scripts? Like, what are you doing with these shorts? Like, what are you going to do with a short story? I was like, I don't know. Edgar Allan Poe did it. Yeah. So, you know, that evolved naturally. And it was just like, oh, everything clicks. All the playing with toy soldiers and being into paintballing and photography and all these things that were kind of swirling around fell into place pretty easily with film.
That's amazing. What were, like, take me back to one of those middle school movies that you guys made.
Well, we started doing our stuff in high school together, but, you know, it was very much like we would show up to each other's house with a camcorder, mini DV tapes, Hi-8 mm-hmm. was like the thing. We'd have these scripts. Usually the characters' names were people from movies we liked. So maybe it'd be like Jules from Pulp Fiction. Yeah. And we would just name a character that we wouldn't even try to, you know, come up with anything. Everything was an homage. You know, if we had to fall back on something, it was, oh, it's an homage. It's an homage. Yeah. And, you know, it was very like slice of lifey kind of dramedy kind of stuff, mm-hmm. just kind of like finding our voice. And I mean, it was so early on and we were both really interested in kind of like visual language. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of like, you know, films like The Fall and stuff like that, that was very visual, and music video directors like Hype Williams and all those people that had a big impact. So it was just as much writing as it was kind of like a visual thing that we wanted to work on, which naturally sprouted into the more film side of things and the music video mm-hmm. and commercial side of things pretty naturally.
So where did you go? Like, did you go to film school? How did you get your start outside of the, you know, child's play isn't the right word.
No, it's child's play. It definitely was.
I think you also just like you sent off like synopses for so many of our listeners, because I have seen my partner and his now writing and directing partner, who they started, became friends with in middle school. I've seen the video that they made that was James Bond and Sherlock Holmes solve a mystery. But like, it's one of those things where they like wake up in the morning and they sleep on the couch together, two couches together, and like get their clothes on together and like go through the motions. It was like very, that was child's play. Yours sounds way more evolved than theirs.
Nah, not really. I mean, by the way, I lost you for a quick second there, so I'm just checking my connection. But yeah, no, it was that, you know, it was just like, we're both in his backyard and we're like testing out how funny it would be to use cap guns instead of real guns for an action scene. And for no reason, you know, there was no voice yet. We were really just like figuring things out, and we knew what made us laugh, and we wanted to kind of lead with that. Mm-hmm. You know, if it makes us laugh, okay, let's put it onto paper. And that's been such a hard thing to chase forever, because we have, I guess, a really specific taste. And so it's nice when you see filmmakers out there with like a really special project, and mm-hmm. you feel like, ooh, this is something I would love to make. Maybe I can't, or I never will, but I would like to. And I know there's other people out there probably making things for themselves. Like in recent memory, I saw Al Warren's film Dogleg, mm-hmm. and I was just like, oh my God, this movie is so good. It's so funny. It's so nuanced. Like I could only dream to ever get, you know, to be a part of a project like something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. What eventually drew you to editing?
Well, so I guess to back up and answer your question from before, we hit the ground running in high school. We started making music videos right away. So I was very kind of like focused on directing and producing and writing. Editing was just something that we did because we had to, mm-hmm. you know, it was just like, we're going to make the thing. Who's going to edit it? We didn't have like editor friends yet.
Hard to come by at that age.
Yeah, really hard. Actually, I was really lucky because he's like a really dope colorist now, but his name is Sam Gursky. But we were all in like, you know, my friend and I were the co-presidents of our high school film club, whatever that is. There was like four of us. Sam Gursky was one of them. And Sam is great. He went on to start, I guess, I don't know if he started it or not, but Irving Harvey, which is like a dope color house in the city for a while. And he was like an editor. And so, you know, we were bouncing things off him early on. And then, you know, it was like a control thing. You want to try to like execute your vision. A lot of that, you kind of do some writing as an editor. You know, I always feel like you're kind of like continuing the writing process when you get there.
Yes.
And so it was like, okay, well, we can kind of craft this and reverse engineer just as much as we start from 0 to 100. We could go from 100 back to 0 mm-hmm. and kind of find something in the middle that is actually what we were trying to go for. And yeah, we were making music videos, made a music video for this band, a local band called Envy on the Coast. We did a lot of work with them at the time. And I don't know why we didn't think about having it edited. And so the label was like, hey, we need this edit. And I was like, oh yeah, of course, of course we do. And I was like, $500, which seems crazy. But at the time I was just like, oh my God, I'm asking for so much money. I don't know what they're going to say. They were like, yeah, okay. And, you know, I did it. That was like a kind of, you know, I had been doing other stuff, but that was the first time I like got paid professionally mm-hmm. to do it. It was just one of the many times where just taking a risk and just speaking up for myself like paid off, because now I'm like, oh, I could be confident. I can actually ask for things.
Right.
Did that. I was working at Red Bull pretty early on at that same time period with a friend named Jeremy L. Bucher. He AD'd that video for us. And then he started at Red Bull and they needed a person who's just like down to learn stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was me.
Yeah.
And so I got there. They were like, hey, you did a video for Wu-Tang and this and that, and you're 20. And I was just like, yeah. And they're like, can you start today? And I was like, all right. You know, so jump right in. Yeah.
$500.
Hey, you know, I mean, I'll take it right now too. You know, at the time it felt like, oh my God, so much money. But you know,
I it's funny because I'm like, yes, $500 actually doesn't sound too bad in this economy. But that sort of initial, I mean, how do you know at that stage, and in general, how do you even know what to ask for when it comes to rates without the experience?
I couldn't even fathomize it at the time. It was very much like, you know, I think they put up $1,000. I was EPing with my partner. Like, we were just putting up whatever money we could. So they put up $1,000. We put up our own $1,000 that we were getting from, you know, we were like waiters and stuff at the time. And so, I don't know, it was just like a quarter of the budget. I was like, a quarter sounds like how much you should spend on editing. Like, sure, you know, and then did that. I guess I learned a lot since then, but kind of just said it. They said, yes, I did it. The next time I was like, okay, 500 is the rate. I got to say 500 again next time. I know I can get 500. And I forget who, but somebody was just like, why don't you just say 1,000 and see what somebody says? I was like, all right, yeah, that works for me. I'll do that. You know, and you just progress from there. Yeah. And then eventually you start to meet people and you trade stories and you ask them, you find out what other people are making. Maybe you're not making anywhere near what you thought, you know, you should be. And maybe that's good. Maybe it's really bad. Maybe you should be making way more and you're, you know, you're not on the mark at all.
Right.
So it's good to kind of communicate with other people and have other filmmakers who are maybe a couple of years ahead kind of coach you into it as well.
1,000%. And it feels taboo to be talking about money and rates, but it's actually critical for your survival. When I had just made one short, but I was working in ad sales, I had a friend offer me a job to do this, like, it was not a commercial, but it was like a social spot for a credit card company. And we got a permit to shoot on the subway in New York. I had no business doing that. And I had no idea what my rate should be. Luckily, the person who hired me was a friend who ended up, we went to film school. I convinced him to come to film school with me. And he told me, he's like, 800, start with 800. And I was like, thank God I knew to ask. I was going to be like 300, 250. I'll do it. Anything for the experience. But like you have to, if you don't have a confidence that you can ask in, I think it's okay to ask, you know, if what is a rate for something like this? Yeah, that's, and then you were.
It's usually way more than you think. By the way, my webcam kind of goes out of focus sometimes. Yeah. Sorry if that's distracting.
No, it's all good.
Lighting. I had a mood lighting. It's taboo, but it's also like, why not? Like, who decided that's taboo? People that are trying to kind of put you in a position that'll marginalize you in the workforce. Right? I mean, that's why people don't talk about money. I'm sure there was a time period where it was not okay, or there were kind of collectively an understanding, but I've never really been into that. I've kind of always wanted to educate people on my experience and also just like ask straight up. Some people aren't really comfortable saying it, which is cool. And you have to kind of figure out the push and pull of asking those questions and knowing what your relationship is with a person when you ask them. But usually you're not charging enough.
Yeah.
Usually you're charging way less than even industry standard is, especially early on. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you don't have the same experience. And of course, there's a scale to it. But at the same time, it's like pretty quickly you get to being good. And when you're good, you shouldn't be getting an eighth of the amount, you know, maybe a quarter, maybe half. But, you know, being so far off the mark, it's like, and, you know, kids at that time, they're not paying their bills.
Right.
Some people are all in, you know. Some people don't diversify. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're just a DP mm-hmm. and they want to really focus on that. And if they're not getting DP work for one reason or another, it's like not charging a little bit more really means like not having groceries that month. So,
yeah.
You know, it's important.
I also think you bring up an interesting point about like, you may just feel this inclination to charge the same rate that you did before, but it is okay to say my rate has gone up. It is now this.
Oh yeah.
And something you should. So let's talk, how did you come to Maxine's Baby? How did you land this job?
Well, I had been working. So there's two directors for the project, Galila Bekele and Armani Ortiz. And I've known Armani for almost near a decade by the time I got involved in the project. I started early on when they were first kind of crafting and shooting some of the mm-hmm. stuff and piecing things together and kind of feeling it out in like a shorter mm-hmm. form. Schedules didn't work out. Another editor came in, John Bertain. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. He came in and he had been working on it for a while. And then Armani and I were just itching to get together and really kind of, you know, craft this thing the way that we had done kind of work in the past. Mm-hmm. So ended up being that I flew out to Los Angeles. I was working on a project for Pepsi at the time, and I was really excited about it because, well, my older brother's a Jets fan, and I was working, well, we're all Jets fans, but my older brothers are like huge Jets fans, and it was like for the Jets. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited. I was like, I can't wait to finish this and show my family, because nobody ever gets it. You know, coming up as a filmmaker, no one around you understands. Yeah. It's like, unless they are in film or something comparable, they don't get it at all.
They're like, why would you choose right. this life?
Yeah. It's like, what do you, why are you up at four in the morning? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So I always love those kind of wins where I can bring home something that's like personal that people get.
Yeah.
So I was excited. And then, you know, I got this call, hey, can you jump back into the project? And can you be here tomorrow? And I was like, what? So flew out to Los Angeles.
So inside you said what? And outside you said, you got it.
Outside, I was like, you guys are crazy. You know, I was pretty forward about it. But I think they wanted to get to a certain, they had kind of like set a goalpost for where they wanted to be. And Armani wanted it. You know, and Galila wanted it to like feel a certain way by this point. And it really was just like, if we don't get in a room for 2 weeks and just jam on this project, we're going to be kind of trailing behind for what we've set out for ourselves. Flew out to LA, I finished the Pepsi project at the studio that was in LA that had hired me. And then at night I was working out of that studio on the film. And then the weekends. God. And then it crossed over where there was no more Pepsi project that wrapped. And then I stayed there for another like week and a half, 2 weeks. They had just bought a house, the studio, right behind it. It's a place called Sawhorse. And they bought a house. The house was unfurnished. They were going to turn it into editing suites. And we just stayed inside of that house and just would like wake up, walk down the road to the studio, work for 15 hours, take naps on the couch, walk back, sleep on air mattresses, come back. And we just like got after it. And Galila was flying in from New York. You know, she was home with her kid and doing all this stuff. So she would like fly in and out back and forth to New York and do reviews with us. It was cool. It was a lot of fun. Probably the most fun part of the project.
It's camp edit is what you're doing. And
yes.
And you're just like heads down powering through. I just picture locked on my first feature and I spent a month.
Congrats.
Thank you. I spent a month with my editor and we went to my parents' house and edited there. And we had like our two little stations and camp edit is where it's at. If you can do that. I mean, I hope that air mattresses aren't always the option, but that sounds amazing. Talk to me about like one, how you like came into the project at that point and absorbed it all. And having to like understand all the footage, the story, the things that they had already tried before. And then also like how you kept momentum during that time. Was this one of those things where you're just like, okay, we have to power through and get to the finish line? Or were you like worried about burning out? How did you find that balance?
I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but I don't really burn out. That's not really ever been a thing for me. I mean, I feel it for sure. The older I get, I feel like, can I curse on here?
Yes.
What the fuck was I doing for my 20s? Like, I mean, I was literally triple booked for 5-6 years at a time. And, you know, I mean, it was just like crazy, but I don't really burn out. I don't worry about that. I worry about people around me. I have like a really, really tenacious work ethic. And so does Armani, though, and so does Galila. So it was like, welcome home, you know? And I'm with the people that are like, we're all cut from that cloth. Yeah. So we clicked. And I click very well with people that like that. Like my friend Brian, I mentioned earlier, who's my creative part. We direct together. Like, it's cool, but like sometimes, like humbly speaking, you feel like you're like Kobe on the basketball team and you want everybody else to show up at practice at 5 a.m. And that's just not their vibe, but that's not how they, you know, create best or maybe their work ethic, whatever. But when you find people like that, it's energizing. Like for me, it's really energizing. Like I'm able to put in a 22 hour day, sleep for 2 hours, wake up and do it again until I physically burn out. And, you know, when you put in so much, the people around you are like, oh yeah, you need to crash for 16 hours. Just do it. You put in a crazy week, you know?
Yeah.
So when you're around like-minded, you know, people with that kind of work ethic, you can really just do anything. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's no, and the goalpost keeps moving.
Yeah.
You know, you think you're done with the edit and then you decide that you forgot a whole, especially in someone's, you know, biopic story. It's like, we really didn't cover his television successes well enough. Mm-hmm. Let's go do that. Let's go shoot more interviews. You know, we're thinking we're nearing picture lock and it's like, we've got to like, you know, not reinvent the wheel, but we're really missing a lot of the story. And you just got to get to a certain point and see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's also energizing. Oh, we're making progress. We're learning. We're seeing, oh, we're actually, this is starting to become something, yeah. or it's not what we want. Good. Now we've got the energy to go get it there. So, you know,
it's kind of addicting, especially when you have those breakthrough moments, I'm sure, or when you're like, okay, now I know what we need and this will fix this other thing. Just knowing that it fuels you. Mm-hmm. Now, you all created this documentary about such a known figure. I mean, Tyler Perry is just ubiquitous and known and loved. How did you approach the story, knowing that people would come in generally knowing who he was? How did you sort of find that entry point?
To answer that, I would probably be best to say that the filmmakers behind the project, who I mentioned, Galila Bekele and Armani Ortiz, were very close to him mm-hmm. personally as a subject. Armani went on to kind of be like a protege of his at Tyler Perry Studios. So they were very close. So there was a real intimacy to the footage. When you're editing something and you're not also shooting it, you're kind of gifted with sort of like an objective viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And you could kind of just look at what's on the film. Like, what is here? What am I actually looking at? What is reading or not? And what can I do to amplify or take certain things away from what's there? But I'm getting all these insights from people who know him really well. And so now I know what to look out for, whether it's a physical tick of someone or how long to wait before something might happen if they know a camera's rolling, because everyone treats it differently. He's been on camera for so long. So he's just great. The camera could just be anywhere in the room. He knows how to kind of move around the room. But you kind of have this figure. And I remember really early on, somebody said, like, when you are making documentaries, you have to fall in love with the subject. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really, really important. Fall in love with your subject for good or bad or whatever. Like, you're telling a story about this person and you want to do the best job possible to really let other people understand your quote unquote love for them. And he's a larger than life character. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said a lot of people love him. A lot of people also throw dirt on his name at the same time. And with a lot of love comes a lot of hate, you know, mm-hmm. and it's unfortunate for people that do magnificent things like him and create jobs for people and do all this stuff. But they did a really cool job balancing it with the interviews. So they had like actual critics of his who had written, not hit pieces per se, but have like very much demonstrated their disdain or how they felt or criticized him in some way. And they went after all of them to say, hey, would you guys like the opportunity to speak on camera about what you think about him, his yeah. work, etc. So I got to see everything. I was kind of sitting at a command center of like, here's all these people saying this and here's all these people saying that. What's interesting is it's overwhelming that even though those voices sometimes sound louder in public forum, mm-hmm. when you really see what's happening privately and you see how people are interacting with their crew, the jobs they're creating, the work that they're doing with the city, work ethic, like I'm seeing his work ethic and I'm admiring it. So it becomes like, wow, there's so much that people don't get to hear about this person because they only hear this stuff, because, you know, sometimes those are the fastest voices, the loudest voices. Mm-hmm. And what was really cool about this film was we got to like put the voices against each other and give the audience an opportunity to say, well, what do you think? Like, here's these people saying this, we'll show you this at the same time, kind of like, you know, form your opinion, you know, as you see fit.
Yeah.
As an editor, I try to have a delicate touch, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you're playing soccer and you want to like not have the ball hit your foot and bounce off. You want to kind of like softly land it where your foot is so you can keep dribbling it. Mm-hmm. It's like that. You don't want to push too hard in either direction because you want the audience to feel like they own the film, like they're filmmakers as well, that their opinion actually matters when they watch it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a powerful position to be in that command center, because so easily by including a scene or taking out a scene, you can upset the balance. And one of the things that I think is interesting and we talk a lot about on the podcast, but specifically when we're speaking with documentary filmmakers is, you know, presenting the information, but the fact that it is not journalism, it's a story and it's being crafted and it's so intentional. The intimacy that you talk about in the film is so apparent with, especially with the filmmakers. There's this scene in particular where he is getting ready to go out and I think give a speech for the grand opening of his studios. And it's when he's backstage and sort of like hyping himself up. And one of the directors, I think, says something to him about, you know, I think it was like, what do you think you would be thinking if you were a kid or something like that? And then Tyler Perry almost like turns it back on him. He's like, don't do that to me. I know what you're doing. And it was sort of this like scene that created this almost meta awareness of he is also a filmmaker. So there, I thought it was such an interesting choice to put that in there. I'm curious to hear about like scenes that you, Eric, being the person who has the audience perspective and is advocating for the audience who wasn't there, who doesn't have that intimate connection, who wasn't feeling the thing in the room. What were some of the scenes that you had to either advocate to take away completely because they weren't adding to the story, or that you're like, we need to put it in, but we need to do more work to create the context?
Well, I would say to touch on that scene in the hallway. So that's Armani talking, who was, you know, he filmed all the Verite stuff in the entire movie. Armani also was one of the editors, by the way. So a lot of those choices come from him and he knows where these nuggets are and he can tell me, hey, I made this thing. Let's fold it into everything else. Or this happened on, you know, at this time, let's use that. Or I have a question and he knows where it was because he shot it and he's also editing. But, you know, the choice for that one in particular is everybody saw the grand opening on television. Anybody who was watching, they saw the red carpet. They saw that side of it. So what's happening on the other side of the door? And there was literally a camera there. And the context is Armani had been following him for years. He wants to ask these kind of questions, but, you know, first of all, your subject might not be in the mood. You might not have earned that kind of a relationship yet. There's a lot of reasons why you can't just ask about someone's abuse, right?
Yeah.
But there was this kind of perfect storm thing that I think it really speaks to the foresight of Galila telling Armani, be there, film this at this time. I think this is going to be good. You know the questions to ask if it seems right, and Armani knowing when was the time to strike. And, you know, a lot of the thesis of the film is around those themes. So this kind of pushing past abuse and pushing past problems in your childhood to get to this, you know, like I said, magnificent position. This grand opening was huge. I mean, it's the biggest studio in America. It's like the third biggest in the world, I think. And not for nothing, he's a Black filmmaker. I mean, it's infinitely harder to do that. So, and he doesn't come from means. He's not someone who had money to just dump in. So we chose to include that for a lot of reasons. Part of it was early on in the film to really establish this language for the audience. Like, hey, you're in it with us. You're going to hear the filmmakers talk. We're going to talk about some really serious subjects. And you're also going to see the kind of glory of what's going on in this guy's life all at the same time sometimes. And while you're looking at him in his white tuxedo about to do a grand opening, just remember where he came from. So it's like really important for us to use that. But going from there, it's like, how much do you talk about abuse? How much, how detailed do you get? Can you do too much? So there was, you know, a lot of push and pull to figure out what was the right appropriate amount of discussing a topic, for example, like that. And also, he's done so many things. He's been in so many movies. He's written so many movies. He's written, directed all these television shows. He's a confidant to a lot of people, like a lot in the industry, and for good cause. And so the other side of it is like, if you show too much of that, it becomes a puff piece. And it's like, but what are we supposed to do? It's not like he didn't accomplish those things. It's not like he didn't get recognized for all those things. So it's definitely like, you know, you're cooking and, you know, you're cooking for other people. It's not just your taste too. You're putting in a little bit of salt. Is this going to be salty for everybody? I like salt. Do they like salt? Maybe I should tone the salt back, put a little bit of lemon in and see what happens, you know? So you got to feel it out. And that's why it's this kind of like ball of clay that you keep molding. You don't have to actually put it in the oven to harden yet. Yeah. You mold it and you show people and you discuss it. And there's two filmmakers, which I think some people would think would be more difficult. There's actually easier because they were so in sync. And if anybody was ever not in sync, we had this like 3 to 4 to 5 person conversation about it. Yeah. Or we would work on a piece and show the other one and say, hey, here's what we're thinking. Oh, okay, well, Sasso, let's go work on this other version of it and show the other person, and you know, and the best idea wins. Yeah. So it's really, it's a balance. It's like making a cocktail or some food or something like that. You want to put the right ingredients in, not too much, not too little. And everybody at the table has to enjoy eating it as much as you can, at least.
Now I'm hungry. Yeah. It sounds delicious. The film has been out in the world. Like, how has it been presenting it? Like, you're like, okay, here's dinner. What do you guys think?
You know, it's interesting. I've done a lot of work, a lot of short form and a lot of other things, longer form stuff, but not where I'm actually like in premieres. Mm-hmm. Credit also to the team for bringing me around too during a lot of that. I don't think people realize that when you go on like a kind of like a press run with a film, or you're just like a string of premieres, you're watching the movie like you thought you've like seen this movie 5 billion times working on it. And then you go and you sit in an audience of people and you watch it again. And then the next day you go to a different theater down the street for a different event and you watch it again. And then you fly to Atlanta and you watch it again. So that part of it, I just was kind of like a shock for me how that feels, because you're sitting in a room of other people. I mean, we're not talking about like 3 or 4 filmmakers. You're working together, advanced preview stuff. We're talking about like it's palpable. If something is funny, people are going to laugh. If something is sad, people are going to moan and cry.
Yeah.
This movie has, you know, a lot of religious moments because of who he is and his DNA. So, you know, seeing how that kind of overtakes people's soul when you're next to them is really interesting. And it was cool, you know, going to the LA premiere. We premiered at AFI. It was like the centerpiece premiere. I was so excited. We went there and I'm sitting next to, you know, quite literally a really important part of his demographic where my seats were. Which was like 40 to 50 year old, maybe, you know, Black women, something in that age range.
Yeah.
And then my friend who is in LA who came to watch it with me. And I got to watch my friend next to me kind of like tear up a little bit, which is, I was like, oh man, like this is, I didn't know that I was going to have to like deal with the physicality of people's emotions next to me. The women next to me on the other side were very religious. So when all those moments came up, they were so excited and they were standing up and waving their hands and stuff. Standing ovation at the end. That's like a crazy feeling, wow. You know? And then we went to LA. Atlanta. And that was like its own crazy experience because he's rooted in Atlanta. And that was like the entire room was his crowd.
Yeah.
So people were screaming and yelling and super excited. There was a bunch of actors from his shows where I was sitting. So all these, you know, I had never met them. I worked on little pieces of their show to put it in the film. And
were you know, like, I know you? And they're like, I know you.
I always creep when you're when you edit like a lot, it's really creepy when you meet people
because you're kind of like destigmatize this. Yeah. The editors, they know the actors because of they probably know more than most people with based off their every little twitch, every little idiosyncrasy.
Oh yeah. Especially with TP. When I finally met him on like a Zoom call. I was just like, oh my God, dude, I know so much about you. It's not even like, I know so much about you. And I was really curious what, you know, he was going to be like as a person. I've seen it all. I've literally seen, I mean, I know intimate things about his characters I work with that no one will ever know, stuff that hits the cutting room floor. And he was just like the funniest dude. He was so, he's a very empathetic person. Mm-hmm. So he could tell that it was going to be anxious for someone to be who's not in his circle normally to be in the room with him. And he just broke the ice. He was making jokes and asking what I thought and felt and, you know, just being able to talk about the, and the film was done by then. So it was just, you know, I was nervous. I didn't know how he would feel. And he was, you know, warmed up really nicely to it. So it was a good feeling.
There's this meta, nature just to this film in particular. He's a filmmaker. You're a filmmaker. I love that you said earlier you have to fall in love with your subject. So I'm curious, in that process, what did you learn about being a filmmaker yourself?
you can always work harder. Like, you could think you're the hardest working person, and then you see somebody like him or Armani. I mean, Armani's so hard work. Galila's so hard work. Galila's got a kid and she's balancing her life. And it's like Asante and Jasmine White, the producers, they've got multiple kids and everybody's balancing so much and working so hard. And it's this project and five others too that they were all focused on. So you can always work hard. You can always definitely work harder. And I don't mean that in the toxic work culture way. I mean, you might think you're a hard worker until you meet someone who's doing 10x your output. And it's humbling. It's really humbling. It's inspiring too, because it's like, maybe I should go and do more that I want to do. So for me, that was like, for example, the music video I showed you. Like, I'm watching this guy. I'm seeing him. He's taking every chance on himself. He's betting so big. He's betting the house every time. This isn't like, you know, these are huge swings that, you know, that he's taking. So for me, I walked away from it saying, I could take bigger swings. I could take bigger chances. Mm-hmm. I can have faith in myself. My taste, there's other people who probably share my taste. So that was really nice. Also, one of the producers I mentioned, Asante White, I work with him on a few projects now since we've gotten really close. He says something that I really love, which is you have to be married to the project. And for better or worse, like, you're going to make enemies, you're going to ruffle feathers. Sometimes people aren't going to want to hear what you have to say. But if you're married to the project and you're really wanting to lead with what's best for the project at all times, you can't lose. You can't, because it's not like you're coming from some self-serving place. The project is everybody's. Everyone from a PA who was on for one day to an editor who was on for the life of the project or the directors or TP as the subject, everybody owns this thing equally.
Yeah.
So you just be married to it, want to make the best thing you can possibly make. And I think that's like Tyler Perry's school of thinking. He's like, I'm making the best thing I can with the resources I have around me, and I'm going to move forward with that.
Yeah. I want to talk about your directing work as well. And let's use this as a transition into sort of like the tech of what you're doing as an editor. And then we'll wrap up with talking about Illest Villains and the horror crossover that I loved. I was watching it the other day and I was like, oh yeah, we have to feature this in the article of this podcast. But before we dig into that, and there actually might be some specific crossover, I want to hear about how you structure your projects in Premiere, specifically for Doc.
Yeah. Well, everything I cut in Adobe Premiere. Like, I've actually fought them to get this project from another NLE into Premiere. So, you know, it was in my hands in Premiere for a little bit. They had been working with someone kind of internally for a little while that was working out of that other NLE, and which will remain nameless, I guess. And, you know, standard. I mean, it's like industry standard to for a lot of people for many years, but it's so archaic and outdated, and they're not making the updates that Premiere makes on a constant basis. I mean, if you look at like what they're doing at NAB right now, and they're just releasing constantly, innovating, constantly trying to stay on parallel with filmmakers and creatives that are using their software in every, I mean, Photoshop, Premiere, Illustrator, even Bridge, just like knowing how to tag files the right way. So I'm like a Premiere Adobe evangelist. So I had to like fight to get the project entirely. We had to hire an AE whose job it was, who knew both, to reconfigure the project into Premiere so that I could join the project. Wow. So with that said, once that was out of the way, well, there's like 500 terabytes of footage or so at a certain point. It was like,
oh my God.
It was a decade of filming him for this with the sole purpose of this. It was all the footage that got filmed along the way for their social at Tyler Perry Studios, all these other things that they were kind of simultaneously filming. We were just gathering everything. It was like a dump truck. You just shovel it towards the hard drives.
You want it all.
Yeah, because you never know if there's going to be a special sparkle in someone's eye on this random day that works with a match cut to something else. You just want all of it if you can get it.
Yeah.
But it's daunting.
So much footage to
have. So much. Yeah. And then they filmed more. Then they went and did those new interviews, which were huge with, you know, Ari Emanuel, who very important person to Hollywood, to say the least. Like, you know, it's like these things that wouldn't have even been in the film. And it's like, all right, now we've got another 3-camera interview we're going to bring in. And, you know, it's going to redefine parts of the story, recontextualize things. And, you know, this footage we had been sitting with and didn't know how to use, but it was like earmarked for later. Yeah. Now this person speaking to that time period. Oh my, you know, now we can use all that stuff. We can color this in. So when setting up a project, you know, in Premiere, what's important for me is, well, Armani and I, he's gonna hear this, I'm sure. Armani builds projects in a really funny way. He builds it like the inside of his brain. So when you open it up, it's the inside of his brain. And that's the best way I could put it. I like to have things organized in what I would say is logical. His yes. is logical in his world. Mine is like, if I have to give the project to somebody else, I want them to kind of know their way around. Maybe intuitive is a good way to put it. And so what I like to do is, especially when you're like collaborative like this, because we're working with John and Armani and it was a team. I like to have sort of like a wide net where it's intuitive. If somebody needed to go and find something, even if that's disorganized, you can organize it. So we're taking in a bunch of stuff from Armani, maybe following around TP in a Chicago residency for a play or something. We've got all this stuff, but we could put it in kind of organized bins according to that. So if I'm looking for anything from that time period, I just at least go to the time period and I can go and kind of fish around from there. That's important. And, you know, the project was in reels for a little while and we had it broken up like that. Something about that just
can
made
I
it,
ask a newbie yeah. question?
Sure.
Because I didn't know what a reel was until 7 months ago when I started working on this movie. So can you tell me what a reel is?
Yeah. So
in the context of modern times.
Yeah. So it's obviously comes from less modern times, but you know, projects were delivered based on, I believe it's the capacity of what a film reel could hold. I think originally I could be wrong. Somebody can fact check me on that. Yeah. Sounds right. I don't know it all either, but
If a listener wants to fact check us,
please.
Correct if needed.
Sucker punch fact check me as hard as you can. I believe it was the capacity of a film reel. So, you know, and definitely when delivering them to theaters for exhibition, you know, you're carrying it's multiple reels and they're spinning them out and the next one comes in. So there's a workflow where you're dividing up the film in reels. Sometimes people will like kind of roughly do, if there's like a 5-act structure, they build around those 5 reels or something like that. Yeah. You try to figure it out. That's never really been how I've worked ever. So it just makes more sense for me. It was just a little easier to kind of have an entire timeline. And what's cool about Premiere is you could do that. Like Premiere can handle like 24-hour timelines. And we had definitely had many 24-hour timelines because it might be a string out of everything that's ever happened when he was doing his play in Louisiana. And it's like 24 hours of content, you know, and it's like, but Premiere could handle it, which is dope. Yeah. And you could share them with each other. So I can, you know, be kind of, or our AE, Jeremy Schaftel, he's awesome. He would build these things. He's also a producer, like outside of his work on this as an AE. So he can think logically, build out string outs for us to look at, us to work with. Galila might just sit down and kind of be, she would actually just jam out with him at Harbor in New York City. And they would just sit and go through stuff. And then they'd like hit me with it, especially when we're moving really fast. So building the project out in a way where the skeleton is something that everybody can move around in if they need to. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, tailor it to how your needs are. Armani has different needs than I have when I open up a project, but we can still communicate through what we're doing with Premiere. And the past
can
few
I
years...
Can I ask another logistics question?
Yeah, yeah.
So were you using Adobe... Is it Projects or...
No.
What is it called?
So...
How did you store it in the cloud and get it so you could be talking to each other and working within the same...
So here's the other thing. So first of all, a lot of those newer Adobe tools, which again, to their credit, they're always innovating. They're realizing that users need things like this and they're making it possible. But for us, what was really cool is we're talking about Premiere Productions, which is a really dope collaborative tool that Adobe has been, you know, refining over the past few years. And it's incredible. But when we first started, this was not, you know, this was kind of like new. There's a lot of tools that got released during the lifespan of the project. So we were, you know, figuring it out. And
it
again,
was the before times before.
Yeah, but it's almost like the during times. So it's like these things were rolling out, and Adobe makes it so easy that we were able to kind of test stuff out. So my first like experience doing any like text-based editing and stuff like that, that was all on this project because I was seeing these tools and, you know, Jeremy and I were geeking out like, oh, this got, you know, announced, let's try it. And, you know, we, during the course of 2-3 years working on the edit alone, you know, Premiere is constantly iterating with new tools and bug fixes and changing stuff and making the users kind of feel heard. So, you know, we got to experience all that, but this project in particular was really high secrecy. So, you know, I mean, not only are there literally presidents in the footage in the film, as you saw, and so it's like, you know, and you know, AAA listers, Jay-Z and Beyonce and these people, it's like, those are his friends. TP himself, he's like almost like a politician. Yeah. So, you know, and there's also like family, you know, things that you just don't want everybody to have access to stuff. Yeah. So especially early on, we had a very, it was very important for us to be physically in proximity with each other working, which is why I went out to LA that first time.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were also able to rely on things like Frame.io, which I've been using for years. I mean, it for me, it came in over Vimeo and just kind of like, I was like, I don't know why I'm using Vimeo at this point. Like Frame is just incredible. It's so much more collaborative.
Yeah.
I can, you know, I can share project files and media assets and do reviews with people. Mm-hmm. So Frame is really cool because Frame, you can operate with that level of secrecy and security, even remotely. Mm-hmm. So we could put up a cut of the film and communicate with each other. Maybe Galila will be in New York and I'll be in LA with Armani, or me and Galila will be in New York and Armani will be in Atlanta where he lives. Mm-hmm. And we're able to kind of communicate these ideas to each other and not feel worried that there's going to be any sort of a security problem or something like that. Another reason why I'm kind of like so bullish on Adobe's, you know, and they acquired Frame. I don't remember what year they acquired Frame, but that was
3 years ago.
That was during the project's lifespan.
Cool. So you were like thrilled, I'm sure.
So happy. I mean, the check boxes just keep, you know, it's just like, I wish this check. Premiere's going to, you know, Adobe's going to get after it. So, yeah.
You must have an in at Adobe that is getting these things down the line.
Maybe recently. I just did an interview with them recently. It was really fun. And it was similar to this. We got to kind of get into the nitty gritty of how the tools were helpful. And I'm stoked about it because, you know, I always say it's like, you know, I wear like Nike hats all the time. I use Adobe for everything. It's like, you want to partner and work with brands and companies like that because you're really going to bring good energy to it. It's not like a fake relationship. You know, you're using the stuff.
Organic and it's very, there's like synthesis there.
Yeah. I had no in yet. I'm not like a very technical person, which is actually something I had, you know, mentioned is I like learning. You know, I just did a project, Art Beats and Lyrics, and it was with this company, Silent Face, and the whole remote workflow. Mm-hmm. And I jumped in this situation. I had like a month to edit and kind of re-edit a bunch of stuff. Wow. And I jumped in and this dude, Dietrich Cook, he's the other editor on the project. One of the other editors on the project. He's like a Premiere wizard. He's like, he grew up in the school of YouTube and, you know, I went to SVA. Like I learned stuff in school. He got after it like on his own. So he's like, when there's a thing he wants to learn about or ask a question, he goes right to Adobe and he asks, and, you know, he shows up at all the events, he's at the summits and the you know, the talking thing. So I just like that there's a spectrum to users. I'm on the opposite end. I'm just like kind of just figuring out what I need to, and I love that I can explore, you know.
It's interesting that you say you put yourself in that category because You have answered something for me that I didn't even know was a problem, but I think I'm very scared of things like upgrades and things like trying out beta things. But the fact that you were doing this on such a high stakes project and it was just part of your exploring and let's keep trying and let's keep like working towards the edge of what we can be doing. Like, to me, that tells me that you're super dialed in. And the fact that you're categorizing yourself as somebody who's not that, I'm like, oh, well, then it seems like so much more accessible. And that is a challenge for me on my next project is I want to be able to be working with the latest version of everything and not operate out of fear. Like I'm afraid to update like my screenwriting software because I'm worried that it'll all disappear. Like, there, it's irrational fears that are not real. And I think, so anyway, you made me feel a lot better about the future.
There's no better thing than being uncertain. I mean, there really isn't. Because even naturally, like, our bodies are made to release chemicals when things are uncertain and we're anxious and we don't know how something's going to be. It's dark in the room. Our eyes are working a different way. We sense fear. We're pumped with these chemicals that will help us, you know, fight a bear. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I chase that feeling in so many ways, but I get very intimidated when it comes to tech because I'm always scared that I'll be left out to dry and do something irreversible. That's my biggest fear.
Well, I have blind faith when it comes to like Premiere because I've just done it for so many years. I'm always like looking forward to new updates and they're always releasing them. And if there even was a bug, they're fixing it right away because they listen to users and they have a feedback form where you can, if you have a question or a concern of any kind, they're listening and they're kind of like making that in real time. So you want the real time updates. You want to kind of be getting after it. And so, you know, I think don't be afraid of that stuff. The other thing too, is you can download a version of it and hold on to your old version. So you just try, you migrate your project and do whatever you want to do and test it out. And if it's not working for you, just continue in the other version of it while you feel comfortable. I'm not a technical person. A lot of people think because I edit a lot, I just fell into editing. It's not like I was just like naturally the type, you know? I have my own fears and my own hesitations about technology to begin with, period. Just every day, like getting on Riverside to talk to you, I'm like, all right, I got to figure this. I call my podcast producer friend. I'm like, everybody uses Riverside. What are the ins and outs of it? And he's just like, dude, you'll be fine. It's easier than you think.
You're nailing it. You're nailing Riverside. I gotta say. Well, let's move towards our final topic, which is how your work as an editor and like understanding how to work within Adobe and other elements of this space, but how that informs your work as a director.
Well, I used to work very briefly for this guy with Brian, my friend, for this guy named Kevin Custer, director editor. And he said this, which I've heard so many people say now since, but he said, editors make the best directors. Because
I totally agree.
You know, people can argue or not all day with that sentiment. That's fine. But the point is, you know, which I think this part's not arguable. When you edit so much, especially if you're editing other people's stuff, you're seeing other people's mistakes. You're seeing what they did well and what they didn't do well. You're seeing what coverage they did get, what coverage they didn't get, what could have been done better or worse. And so, you know, making a shot list now, I know all the inserts. I'm not second guessing what I need to cover a scene.
Yes.
And when it comes time, as it does, as you know, you're an independent filmmaker too. And when it comes time to, you know, okay, we got to cut something. Hey, we're down on time. We've got this story. It's in everybody's heads. They've written it out. It's this beautiful thing that everyone wants to see get made in the world. But reality check, we're on set, time is money, something's got to get cut. As an editor, you already know how to make cuts. You're used to it. You're comfortable with that, like I said, uncertainty. And so you're kind of able to say ahead of time, I know what I probably won't even use. So let's cut that first. I know what probably would be a waste. Let's get rid of that. Okay, now is the hard part. One of these two things has to go and I want both. And then you've made that choice so many times as an editor, or sitting over an editor's shoulder, at least if you're in the room with the edit enough, that you're on set, you can even just say, all right, here's my discretion. You know, I gotta use my discretion. This is what's gonna get cut. This is what we're gonna prioritize. Oh yeah, we covered the scene. Let's move on. So it's very valuable. It's extremely valuable.
It changed my life, like learning how to edit. I can't believe I ever even tried to direct before I knew how to edit.
I feel the same way. I was talking, he's become like a mentor of mine, whether he wants to be or not. His name is Patrick Smith. He teaches me. I've been really focused on development the past few years and kind of learning how to build projects from nothing and help other people get their projects made and seed my stuff out into the world. And Patrick always answers my questions. He's incredible. And I was talking to him about this, and I probably early on was, I thought I could direct, I thought I had all this moxie. I was young and I just wanted to go and see my ideas out in the world. I wanted to write it and go make it. And maybe there's this like prestige feeling of being a director. And then I spent a lot of years and a lot of time in the seat, so to speak, you know, as an editor. And I was nowhere near where I really thought I was going. And it took me a lot of humbling experiences and time to, you know, really be in school, learning from other people, seeing other footage. Now I am so much more confident when I direct. Now I actually, I know what I want to get. I've seen other people's mistakes as well as mine. And, you know, and my partner too, he edits just, we both, you know, we're career editor directors. So we know how to communicate these concepts to each other. And it's like, yeah, you know what? We're not going to use that. Let's not even bother. Let's just cross it off the shot list. Too much money. This is going to cost too much. Let's, you know, we're looking at it as producers from the editor perspective. So now we're kind of, you know, we made this music video for 22Gs recently. And that project was like, we were editing it before we even got there. I mean, in our heads, you know, we knew what we wanted to do and how we wanted to see this thing get made. And we knew we wanted to do like practical effects. We made that river that they're in is like man-made with Scott Hansen, Digital Thunderdome in Atlanta. Shout out to them. Cool. Yeah, the cave was man-made, all this stuff. And so it was like, we want to take those big swings. What do we have to do to minimize in other categories so that we can accomplish the things we really want to do and what we're setting out to do with the project and, you know, creatively, like where we're going with it.
That's a superpower to be able to understand that and know where, essentially where you can get the most bang for your buck based off of like the aesthetic that you want to go for. And if you can like, I mean, we've all been on sets where we're just seeing so much waste, like whether it's, you know, a costume being fussed over where in reality, it like is never even, it's left on the cutting room floor,
exactly.
But people aren't able to do that filter, that filtering and that editing in real time. I mean, that is truly a superpower.
TP does that really well. That's something I've witnessed in his footage. He makes on the spot answers. He already knows how the thing's going to cut together. He talks about it in one of the scenes in the film. And yeah, that was definitely something. It's nice to see other people doing the thing you want to do really well, doing it really well. So you can kind of say, that's what it looks and feels like. It helps your vision board, so to speak, to see someone actually doing something. And it's like, okay, it is possible. I'm going to go after it. I'm watching Galila and Armani do the same thing, making these like super decisive call outs. And I'm just like, yeah, I could do that too. You know?
So cool.
Yeah. So it's definitely really good.
Can you tell me a little bit about your learnings in the development space? I mean, that's so, we rarely have people come on and talking about that.
Yeah. It's been a really big focus of mine for the past few years to, you know, it's a film industry and there's a lot of money moving and decisions being made. And unfortunately, they're not always made by the creatives that you would want maybe making them. It's cool. It's good to have business people making, you know, business decisions, of course, but it's not always right for the project or their pairings aren't always perfect. So I started to get involved with it when I was at an ad agency. And I also worked on the original content side called Laundry Service. And the original content side was Cycle. And I kind of just got thrown into show running over there. Another mentor of mine, Nicole DeFusco, she was like, give this guy a chance. He's like so into this, like, you know, and that really got me going. And I realized that like you can conceptualize projects or see other people conceptualizing projects, decide to go after those things, build the slate out and, you know, see things go out into the world. So I decide and, you know, a lot of people who are doing it are a little older. They're more veteran. So I decided if I just start learning as much as I possibly can and trying to seek out these mentors and trying to seek out people that can coach me into it and making my own mistakes and taking my own chances, then in a few years' time, I'll be able to start doing those things myself. I could just watch from closer up than maybe someone who isn't interested in it or is interested too late. And then I can start to be someone who knows how to move money around or be someone who knows how to package a project and add attachments. And so the past few years had really been focused on that. And some very exciting developments have been kind of like happening for me in the past, you know, couple of years, but especially the past few months. And, you know, I'm excited about kind of the natural evolution of my career and where it's going, and follow, you know, around, you know, and see what happens next. I can't get into some of these things, but there are some really exciting projects I have, hopefully as soon as this summer, that I think are really going to put some people on the map that I think really deserve to be seen.
That's awesome. Where can people follow your work?
You can find me on Instagram at Sasso. My website's ericsasso.com. That's the best two places to probably find me. Everything links from there, you know?
Amazing. Okay. Watch this space. Well, as we wrap up here, what advice do you have for emerging filmmakers? And let's talk, since we're geeking out about editing here, let's talk about emerging editors.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say I'll speak to both probably with the same thing. You need to become a pro at uncertainty. Like, this is, you know, this is life advice, really. I mean,
yeah,
shit's just going to hit the fan. Like, do you want to be somebody who curls up in a ball when that happens? You know, it's not really going to serve you or anybody around you to be like that. And I know everybody is built with different skill sets, but if you can really start to almost sort of stoically kind of approach things in a way that, like, you practice being uncertain, you're okay. Mm-hmm. You, like you said, you chase after it. Mm-hmm. Then when it happens in real time, you're like, okay, this is not a drill. But I had the drill. We did the fire, you know, the fire alarm already. I know what to happen if there's, I know what to do if there's a fire, and it's calming. It's like, I'm a pro at this. I'm not a rookie who doesn't know how to handle this thing. I've dealt with uncertain times in life, and I've carried that into filmmaking. Being a filmmaker is not easy. It's like one of the, you know, I think people think it's like this cushy thing. It's hard, man. You don't eat, you don't sleep, you lose friends, family doesn't understand you. Girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever you got in your life, partners, significant others. It's really, really, really hard for people to understand that you've got this sort of fire burning inside you and you need to create, you know?
Yeah.
And it's amplified as a filmmaker, because when your certain other art disciplines don't have as much money to just get the idea off the ground, you know, it's getting easier these days. But so, there's that. And then the other thing, and I think this goes for everybody, but especially editors, things don't craft exactly how you want them to. Like,
yeah.
And as an editor, whether it's your project or someone else's, it's sort of your job to do the, like, I don't know, wabi-sabi thing and just enjoy that now you've added character.
Yeah.
Now you have to come up with a solution that wasn't even part of the plan. How are you going to make this idea work or not? Or what are you going to do to, you know, put this thing together in a way that's beautiful? That's more beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wanted to make a vase. The vase fell on the floor. Now it's shattered. You're the editor. Put it together. Make it beautiful. Make it shine in this room that, like, no one would have looked at this vase if you didn't do it with the gold trim that you now added, you know?
Yeah.
So that, and like I said before, you know, you're at the final stage of writing as an editor. You're continuing to craft the story. If you know, you allow yourself to think that way, then you are in a really powerful position. And, you know, if you do a good job, you can really make your other people's projects very special and actually get finished, you know?
This, the vase shattered on the floor analogy and pieced back together, like, that is almost the epitome of that reaction of learning how to embrace the uncertainty. Most people see that shattered glass and they run away or they curl up in a ball and give up. But to embrace it and to pick up every piece and to put it together in a way that is so unexpected, I mean, that is what's so beautiful about that final stage. And it's scary as hell. But it's also, when that work goes into it, it can become so much more and so much better than you thought it could ever be.
For sure. For sure. There's a lot of weight on your shoulders when you're editing, especially. But like I said, if you can deal with uncertain times and things didn't go the way the filmmaker or yourself intended, and you're good at solving those kind of problems, you could become, like, really sought after in a way that people, you know, they can't put their finger on it. You know, you're not just good at editing. There's always going to be somebody who's better at cutting and effects and using tools. But if you are a good problem solver, you're going to position yourself in a way that people want to keep you in the room, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, sounds like just the energy that you're bringing to this conversation is just like, oh, this is like somebody that I want there during the hard times.
Yeah.
Like, this is like the je ne sais quoi of a team that you want to build with. So I hope everyone's taking notes. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric. It was truly a pleasure.
Thanks. This was so awesome. I appreciate being here.
Thank you so much, Eric, for joining us and for being so open and honest and vulnerable about all the stages of your process. What a mensch. I really, really enjoyed speaking with him. And I would love to hear what you learned from the conversation, dear listeners. Thank you for tuning in, being part of our community. You can like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get podcasts. You can also follow us on social media at No Film School. And you can also follow me at Lost in Graceland. And I always love hearing from you. What's working with the podcast? What's not? You can also get more No Film School, of course, at nofilmschool.com, including an incredible backlog of stories about editing and creating and crafting music videos and documentary and narrative. Go there and take things into your own hand, just like all of our guests tend to be doing these days, which is so inspiring. Until next week.